This is Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3 102.1.
And this is Bob Fitrakis, and we've got guests today from Insurgent Theater, and I think that's radical, is it not, Connie?
I think it's pretty radical.
Would you like to introduce our guests?
Yeah, we have Ben Turk and Wesley Coleman, two performers in the play, In the Belly. Which they have written and produced themselves, and they're on tour these days with their play. And they recently came to the Columbus Free Press and gave a performance on their play this this past weekend, and it was excellent.
At a second Saturday Salon live Insurgent Theater performance in the name of the play In the Belly. Would that be In the Belly of the Beast? And are we talking about the prison industrial complex?
I think we got it from, if you consider the society we live in a beast, then prison's the belly.
And of course, there's a very famous book, it was Mr. Abbott, who was let out and committed a crime, but wrote very, very interesting stuff about prison life in America, which makes you question whether the prisons are actually the solution to anything, right, other than a way to incubate take nonviolent people and make them violent.
Yeah, if you really look at the effect that prison has on society and on certain targeted communities, it doesn't have anything to do with rehabilitation or public safety. It becomes pretty clear that what prison is doing is keeping those communities down and keeping them trapped in these kind of cycles of violence.
It seems like there's also a connection with continuing the legacy of slavery that we have in this country. Just given that most of the people who are incarcerated are people of color, and the labor issues that go along with that. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and we talk about it in our play a lot. And I think it's really important, like, when thinking about it, thinking about the prison system, to remember where police and the prison system evolved out of in this country, and that's out of militia and slave catchers. And it's continued its legacy throughout throughout the years. A great book we all read to, like, inform us on it was called The New Jim Crow, and it talks about like the movement from after slavery, there were the Jim Crow laws, and when those ceased to exist, sort of politicians still needed something to keep poor whites and poor blacks separate and divided, and the war on crime was born, and that quickly morphed into the war on drugs, and now one out of 12 black men is incarcerated in our country. So there's definitely, like, a clear progression from slavery to where we are today.
And even in, like, specific details, like Angola Prison in Louisiana used to be slave barracks, and prisoners in Mississippi pick cotton. So there are some very, like, overt, obvious examples and continuations of that tradition.
Now, was yours based on some people I talked to after seeing your play and the nudity interpreted it as sort of modern political prisoners who are under constant surveillance and stripping? Recently, the military guy who did the WikiLeaks, prior to that, people that were in the weather underground, that a particular heinous type of incarceration that really is torture.
Mm. I mean, it's based on administrative segregation or long-term solitary confinement, which is not just used for political prisoners. It's used for, like, supermax-level prisoners. And political prisoners are often treated more harshly or punished in this way. But, yeah, like, in the Ohio State Penitentiary, for example, here in Ohio, in Youngstown, when we go visit people up there, they have to get strip searched before they come in to talk to us, and then they have to talk through, like, bulletproof glass, and then strip searched on their way back to their cell. And they're in, like, complete isolation and still need to be strip searched for no good reason other than to humiliate them and dehumanize them.
And again, part of that would be not going outside in some cases, the use of lighting to disturb sleep patterns, which really comes out of torture manuals, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So it seems like any kind of excuse of rehabilitation that, you know, there was the penitentiary movement, Jean-Michel Foucault, which I think you also listed in the program,
yeah.
He talked about, you know, the... he talked about the move from public torture and stoning and like public punishment to, you know, privatizing punishment. Where was I going with that? but really, I think one of the excuses or justifications for having prison and moving away from that public, having punishment in the public eye was. They were creating the penitentiary, penitence, the idea of, you know, that people would go and pray and, you know, be reformed somehow. And here we have very few educational programs. And so it really just seems like, you know, that that justification for prisons no longer exists, and we're definitely not doing it. It's just a containment unit for certain people in our population.
And that's something we thought a lot about because we did read the book you're talking about. It's Discipline and Punish, and it traces sort of the history of punishment from Europe and how it developed in Europe and then to today in America. And we're actually going to expand the play to include more theoretical stuff from that book. And something we thought a lot about was how, like, when... in torture times in medieval Europe, when the state decided to murder someone, it was very public, like you were saying. Like, it was up on a scaffold and it was a public spectacle. And lots of times the crowd was okay with it and it was sort of, or it was like, you know, entertainment. But sometimes if the crowd didn't agree with what the state was doing, they stopped it. They, he cites many times when the crowd would like rush the executioner and throw him out and
burn the scaffold down.
I mean, that would be great if we still had that option.
Right
now, and it's like if there's a prisoner who's being executed,
it's completely hidden.
It's completely hidden, and people can protest and write letters and do multiple appeals, but the state still has the ability to kill that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we don't have the, you know, 700,000 people were signed petitions, including the Pope and Jimmy Carter and all of that to try to save Troy Davis from being lynched in Georgia, and that wasn't enough. And, you know, there were huge protests and vigils outside as they were doing it, but they had no ability to get in and actually stop it.
Yeah, and the state still kills people in our name. People are killed to protect us, the citizens of, you know, the United States. Yet we don't have any say or any power, really, to influence it. So, thinking about those comparisons, you know.
All right. So we have Ben Turk and Wesley Coleman here talking about their play In the Belly. I guess formally called ADSEG for administrative segregation. And just to describe for the listeners a little bit, I'll just get it started. The play involves three people who are, I guess, showing us, showing the viewer what it's like to be in solitary confinement. And so there are three people in the space that I guess is about the size of a cell. And even though there are three people in there, they're not really communicating with each other. They're not, it's symbolic. They're in the cell separate from each other. Could you talk about the significance of that, of having three people in the same space who are not in the same space? Is it about isolation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's as though we take three isolation cells and superimpose them on top of each other. We're all in the same theatrical space, and it's kind of a multiplication of that solitary confinement and overlapping. And I'm not exactly sure how or why that works theatrically or, like, symbolically, but it seems to have the effect of not just telling a single prisoner story or not just taking this as a single thing, but like multiplying it and showing how there are, I mean, there are
something
like 15,000 inmates.
People? Yeah, how many people are in solitary confinement as we speak?
In the U.S., I believe the figure is 15,000.
Okay, so that's a lot of people experiencing the same thing, but not able to communicate with each other about it.
Right. Though there are some ways. I mean, people have all kinds of tricks, like passing notes under the door and things like that. And sometimes those very rudimentary forms of communication do allow them to organize some pretty amazing things, like the hunger strike at OSP back in January, or the even bigger hunger strike out of the secure housing units in Pelican Bay and Corcoran in California right now.
And we do see that in the play a little bit, where the two female characters are kind of yelling across the walls to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, and we even, like Ben said before, we go visit people at the Ohio State Penitentiary who have been in solitary for 18 years now. And we plan our visits so that we'll visit two people at the same time, but it can't be in the same room, so it's like you visit in this like glass room, two glass rooms right next to each other. And so sometimes it takes like 5 minutes for the guards to let us in to go see them, and during that time they get to talk to each other and yell between this thick glass. But you know, it's times like those that I think they really treasure, because they can have some other human contact other than a guard.
Now, neither of you or the other party have been in prison.
No.
Do you, in terms of dialogue, do you make the visits not only to get the experience, but to come up with an authentic voice as to how prisoners would communicate? And
I mean, our visits are primarily for the activists, the work that we're doing, and to just learn more about how prison works and more about what these guys need. But we've sent in scripts and like done a lot of correspondence, not only with the people that we visit, but with other inmates, and just like got a lot of feedback and a lot of feedback from formerly incarcerated people in the audiences and stuff like that. But we were really cautious about authenticity and about like stealing people's voices, and so we wanted very much to acknowledge that we are, you know, privileged white people who have not been to prison, and we're talking about this, and we're trying to talk about it from that angle, and trying to be transparent about what our role in the prison system is, and that we can't speak for or truly represent the people who are more directly affected by it.
So you mentioned that you're activists, which I'm aware of, and it sounds like, well, I know that you do other activism related to the prison industrial complex. You're also, I think, both active in Redbird Books to Prisoners and maybe some other projects. Would you like to talk about some other of the other projects that you've been working on?
Yeah.
What is Redbird?
Oh, it's just funny because all of a sudden my life has become prison all the time. we've been laughing about that recently. But we work with a group called Redbird Prison Abolition, which is also includes Redbird Books to Prisoners. And it's a group based around prisoner support. So a lot of the things we do come from prisoners themselves, from corresponding with them and them letting us know what they need. So some of those things include sending books to prisoners, and so prisoners can write in to us, and just request books, and we send them a zine catalog with some radical literature they can request as well. And then, Redbird does other things like, help circulate prisoner newsletters and, I don't know, what else?
This is Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton on WCRS 98.3 102.1.
Well, I was thinking as you were talking, it's probably a good sign that your life is revolving around prison reform, because we had huge prison reform movements in the 60s and in the 70s. And when normal citizens and activists began to not advocate, we really had a tripling of the prison population in the 1980s, and a really sort of a consolidation. So now with 4% of the world's population, 25% of everyone locked up on planet Earth is in our country. So maybe, I mean, it doesn't seem like the prisoners really have the leverage in this society where, you know, their cells for private companies are profit units as opposed to cells to do the reform themselves. But when people have actually advocated for them, it causes at least the most conscious of us to reflect on the nature of that system. Mm-hmm. So do you think there is a new prison reform movement brewing?
There's definitely a movement around mass incarceration. Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, has really done a lot to amplify that. But we've also talked to, like, Lorenzo Comboa Evans, who's a political prisoner from back in the day, who's really trying to work around that. And that has less to do with, like, reforming the way people are treated in prison and more to do with reducing the number of people who are going to prison and changing the way that laws are enforced and the way that minority populations are targeted.
And really, to some extent, the smaller government, anti-big government libertarians and some of the Republicans see it as incredibly costly. Mm-hmm. I know sort of the cutting edge is kind of the drug movement, the whole notion that many of the people in there are drug addicted or small-time sellers that haven't done anything violent, and it costs so much to lock these people up. Mm. I mean, the question is whether in the long run our society can even sustain that level of incarceration.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. It seems like even Kasich has taken notice of this and has reformed the Ohio Revised Code, adjusting penalties so that, the level for felony theft, instead of $500, it's now $1,000. I think adjusting the penalties for cocaine and crack so they're brought into a more an equal level for penalties and sentencing. But is that really I guess it's interesting that Kasich has maybe caught on to some of that, but I am wondering about the motivations for that and whether that's, you know, what we're really looking for. I'm interested to see what Bob has to say about Kasich reform, like reducing some of those penalties as well.
No, I think it's a money issue, is that, and he's not really opposed to prison, right?
No.
He's pro-privatization of prison,
right,
which is another trend in and of itself, which could be in many ways scarier than the public facilities.
Mm-hmm. I mean, prison, whether it's private or public, has been a cash cow for a lot of corporations. Like, the prison industrial complex is a real thing. But privatizing prisons does increase that. And it's interesting to look at the trends that come with privatizing prisons. Like, the cost per inmate is lower, and so Kasich and other people will be like, look, we're saving money. But the tendency of, like, recidivism rates and conditions in the prisons are so much worse that you end up incarcerating more people. And so you're saving money per person, but you're putting more people in, so it's ending up to cost more money. And that just shows that clearly Kasich, like, first of all, doesn't care about people because he's incarcerating more people in worse conditions in order to save money. And secondly, is mainly interested in funneling money to private corporations through these processes. And that those kinds of laws have been supported. Like, Corrections Corporation of America works closely with the American Legislative Exchange Council, not only on privatizing prisons and increasing incarceration rates, but also on, like, the laws around immigration, and because of the detention centers there are a lot of money for them as well. So the whole legislative apparatus, we all know that corporations own our politicians in many ways, but the prison corporations do that as much as any others.
Well, yesterday, that would be October 10th, the Green Party endorsed a movement out of California that's being sampled in Ohio, which is sustainable prisons that are actually green and teach workers actual skills, which is odd because CURE, the other advocacy group, has also endorsed it. That is, the prisoners grow their own food supply. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of stuff we used to do in the past. Instead, we bring in these private contractors where they actually grow their own food and actually learn skills where they can actually get a job when they get out that are related to green technology. I mean, at this point, and I don't know how we got there, but what are the prisons actually doing to reform any of these people at the current moment? Mm-hmm.
Little or nothing, and the jobs thing is a total myth. I mean, especially for people of color. When you get out of prison, regardless of what skills you acquired while you were in prison, it's very, very, very difficult to get a job with
a
record.
It's a black mark on your record. Yeah. So. Yeah.
And so,
a mark on your record.
A lot of the inmates that I've talked to are like, you know, these jobs that they're having, the job training that we're getting is not about, they tell us that it's in order to help us get jobs when we get out, but it's actually, like, I talked to a guy who was a plumber in the prison, and he was, like, kept getting flopped on parole, and the reason for that was because they needed someone to do the plumbing in the prison, and so by training people how to grow the food, that they're, like, the prison's becoming dependent on the people who are good at growing food and keeping them there.
Yeah, I had a hard time when I was looking at the proposal, for the Green Party with the green prisons. It did sound like there were some, you know, maybe lifestyle improvements for the people that it would affect, that it would bring in more sunlight and healthier food to people who are incarcerated. But it did not address the objective of abolition. So it was kind of, you know, I'd say a difficult policy to decide whether, you know, we wanted to support that or not. And CURE is, do you remember what the acronym? It's
Citizens United for the Reform
Reentry?
Of Errants.
Reentry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's...
Oh, okay.
No, it's errants.
Reform.
So they call them
so CURE errants. Is, seems to be like an abolition group.
But it really was CURE's proposal. It was the CURE people that wanted the Green Party.
Right.
Apparently, you know, sunlight, being outside, growing your own food, being in contact with, you know, sustainable. The other notion is when they get out is that they really have no skills. But even with the rise of urban farming, is that if you could grow food in the future, that may be one of the greatest skills you can have in this society if the economy collapses. There's plenty of vacant lots, and if you're stuck in the urban areas.
Yeah, so I don't know that it would necessarily, like, achieve the aims that ideally that we would want necessarily, but it would maybe have a positive impact on some people's lives. So it's kind of, you know.
One of the most interesting parts of the book we were talking about earlier, Discipline and Punish, is when he talks about the relationship between reform and the continuation of the system. And he says that since the inception of incarceration as a way of dealing with aberrant behavior or crime or whatever, people have been talking about how it doesn't work and it needs to be reformed. And those reforms, like, from the very beginning, and it's not true that there's, like, the system and then the reform and things get better and then there's another reform and things get better. It's, like, it's not a causal relationship like that. The reforms are often the ones, especially the reforms that get through, are the ones that make the system more efficient for its real purpose of controlling the population.
Except it would seem, though, if somebody never goes outside, never gets any sunlight, and has to be behind glass, if they could go outside and grow their own food, that would seem like a giant leap forward from a system that allows torture. Mm-hmm. Well, so it's on the one hand, is that, it's a reform measure. And really, the prisoners like it for whatever reason. I suspect it's because they're out of their cell and they're actually doing something they have some control over. So But of course, you know, it doesn't abolish anything, mm-hmm. and it doesn't change the macro level of of the numbers, which is, I mean, the only thing that does that is, you know,
the way
what we see is crime and
the way
you know,
I looked
medicalizing
at it.
Drug addiction would immediately, you know.
The way I looked at it is that there are all these policy reasons why we don't like prisons. They're not sustainable. They're bad for the environment. They torture people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so a proposal for reform, like the Green Prisons proposal for reform, it addresses some of those things, but it doesn't really address the underlying cause. It addresses the symptoms. So, okay.
Except the Green Party's on the record for legalizing hemp, among other things, as well as marijuana and medicalizing. So, I mean, most of the reason people are in prison disproportionately black is because of an endless war on drugs that targets a specific urban community and lower class people and allows large corporations to peddle drugs all they want and synthesize heroin. So, so as long as that's not the debating issue, you're never going to get rid of the prisons. Right? Right.
Well, my next question for our guests, we have Ben Turk and Wesley Coleman from Insurgent Theater. You know, as you've performed your play, you've had a lot of contact with audience members and other folks who are incarcerated. And I know that we have in Columbus, we have Occupy Columbus happening here, a la Occupy Wall Street. And it sounds like you had maybe a positive experience recently with someone who saw your play and who also came to Occupy Columbus.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah, we went down there. We went down to the State House yesterday to participate in the beginnings of Occupy Columbus, and spent a number of hours there with like a stand and like to me, I think it's important for especially the Occupy movement to recognize that the struggle didn't start on September 17th on Wall Street. It's been going on since this country's inception. People have been struggling for change. And so we went there to talk about prisons because we want people to connect with that history of change. So we brought letter writing for political prisoners, people who have been inside for 30 years, and also just awareness of other prisoner protests and things that are going on. But yeah, there was a guy there who had seen the play actually here at the Free Press who had brought a sign that said, you know, prisoner rights. So it's we're beginning, and people are very like open to hearing these things. So it's really exciting. I think there's a lot of like novice people involved in the Occupy movement, but they're really open minded, and I'm excited to be reaching out and cooperating with them.
Well, and Bob was just saying that you know in the 60s and 70s there is the prison reform movement, and that they were actually successful in some ways, you know, and so I think, I guess I would like to know kind of what your goals and hopes for success for your activism are in our last couple minutes of the show.
We don't like campaign oriented sorts of work. We like to start with identifying needs and with connecting to people who are affected and who need to be empowered and need to have their voices amplified. And so we don't think in terms of goals. I mean, the big goal is abolition, but the process of getting there is about connecting with people.
Okay. Thank you so much for being our guests. We've had Ben Turk and Wesley Coleman from Insurgent Theater, and recently they performed their play In the Belly. This has been Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell-Newton on WCRS 98.3 102.1.